Hey there, and welcome back to Crypto Clarified. This is the podcast series where we come together from time to time to discuss the most captivating headlines and trends from the crypto space. My name is Benjamin Dean, and I'm a director in WisdomTree's digital assets team. Today, I'm joined by Nick Carey, who's a co-founder at blockchain.com. Before we kick off social media shout-outs, if you're in the US, listeners, check out wisdomtreeprime.com, Apple, Android store. I don't mind where you look, but check out the app. It's pretty cool. Hit subscribe if you're a podcast listener. Share it with your friends. It's a very satisfying click, that the subscribe button. So try it out. You'll love it. And as always, you can find me on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. On today's episode with Nick, we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of different topics. We're going to talk about cycles in the crypto industry. We're going to talk about adoption curves. And you know how much I love talking about adoption curves. We're going to talk about my favorite acronym as well that cheerleader Larry's been talking about, ESG. He's ditched it. So it'll be interesting in the context of Bitcoin. Finally, we're going to kind of wrap up with the joys of entrepreneurship and then thinking about the future with a capital F. Because if there's anything we love more than clarifying crypto here, it's talking about the future. Super interesting, folks. Before we begin, a shout out to James and Sam in compliance. This is everyone's favorite part of the show. Before I begin, I have to say the following to clarify the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of WisdomTree and blockchain.com and are subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, nor as investment or tax advice. Information and opinions expressed in this podcast, underlined, are not a recommendation, offer, a solicitation by any securities and reliance upon them. Also underlined, is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember, past performance is no indication of future results. Now we're on to the fun stuff. Nick, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Now, usually we kick off the episodes just by hearing a bit about the background of guests. And, you know, you and I share a few things in common. One of the things we don't share in common is our names. My name's Benjamin, your name's Nick. But we do speak the same languages, which are English, obviously, French, and Spanish. Give people a little bit of an insight into your background and how you got into the space.
En français ou en espagnol?
C'est comme tu veux.
We'll keep it in English today, I think. otherwise, we may be practicing not as effectively. I grew up in Colorado, my mother is French, and my father lived in South America. And so I got kind of an international, upbringing, and that was sort of what informed a lot of my early perspectives on the world. And I was very lucky to be able to travel a bit, to go visit my family that lived abroad, and learning a little bit about how inconvenient it was to keep in touch with family members. This was sort of pre-Skype, even making payments for things at the time was extremely inconvenient. And that all sort of was, I would say, early lessons in my adolescence. I've always been fascinated by entrepreneurship. My first business was digging up clams on the Long Island Sound and selling them to my neighbors. You know, I built a lemonade stand. Then, you know, one of the grumpy old neighbors said I didn't have a license to serve food. And I remember someone from health and safety came out and saw that it was like a 12-year-old kid trying to sell some lemonade for 50 cents. And that person bought some of my lemonade, and the grumpy old neighbor didn't really have a good case against me. So anyway, winning hearts and minds as a young entrepreneur. And then I actually kind of built my first real business with one of my best friends in high school. We started making websites, and that's where I got really obsessed with just the whole idea of building interfaces and tools that were useful to people. And it was just a really fun way to work. And so we built an order management system for a restaurant. And at the time, the deal we did, because we were kids and we didn't really understand the complexities of business negotiation, was we would get unlimited free sandwiches for life if we built this online order management system. And it was a great deal for about a year and a half until the restaurant went under, and we never got any more free sandwiches. But we built an e-commerce platform and early messaging system for a big oil and natural gas company. So just tools with web tech. And after that, I went to university and studied politics and government, business, and a little bit of constitutional law, and really didn't know what I wanted to do. other than I love being online and working with computers, but I actually became a teacher and worked in a rural school in India, taught computer science and creative writing. And after a tour duty there, I was able to join the founding team of a tech startup. And at 21 years old, basically being the first kind of organizational employee of the team, it was just one of us, me and paired with a developer, and we built with my partners what eventually would become Pipeline CRM, a customer relationship management software. But if you get an opportunity at any point in your career to really get early in a business, it gives you an incredible breadth of experience. I mean, you end up having to do the taxes, to do the client calls, to do customer remediation. You have to figure out which vendors to approve. You have to build software, make recommendations. You have to, hire people. You have to hold people accountable. And learning to do those things was hugely informative early on, and I was there for quite a while. And then it was about 7 years later that I learned in 2011 about a digital currency called Bitcoin. And thus begins my sort of journey into the second sort of epic of my career.
Before we move into that second epic, I did some research on the interwebs before we had a chat, and I saw the terms international political economy. That's you did study that, right?
Yes, I did. IPE. So I don't usually bring that one up because most people don't know what it is, but it's actually a combination of the things I discussed, which was business, politics, and economics. It's sort of a different way of saying international relations, but IPE was actually the topic that I majored in.
Hey, I totally get it. And the reason I bring it up is because there's now kind of like a recurring theme in these episodes. Because when we have guests on, I'd say one out of three maybe has studied political economy and has that combination of background that you've described. And this is the bridge to get into your second epic. It's like if you see it, like you understand economics, politics, an international dimension, and then the technology part. Like you can't unsee Bitcoin when it turns up, and you can't unsee this technology as it evolves and emerges. So go straight into the second epic, but it's just hilarious that so many people turn up with exactly that background.
Yeah, I'm not sure what would have, there's something there, obviously. I think I was always very, almost like passionately obsessed with politics and reading everything I could about it. I remember my grandfather used to teach me about reading balance sheets, and so understanding the stock market was something I was always sort of obsessed with. And then, with the background in technology, these three things merging together at an intersection right when, my start my career really with the great financial crisis, you sort of really fundamentally ask some important questions, which is like, well, what is money and where does it come from? And this was not something that I got to study in school. And actually, I've been at universities, all over the world now to talk a little bit about the history of money. And it's astonishing, even teachers in academic courses where there's rigor around finance and maths actually don't know where money comes from in terms of like how it's introduced to the economy, how it flows through an economy, and the decisions around how much of it should exist and the criteria that is, sort of applied to do that. And so, what's interesting to me is if you just actually start there, what is money and where does it come from? Well, it's a really old concept. We find evidence of, for example, beads in burial tombs in northern Scotland that came from the Middle East. And these are prehistoric monuments. And so before there was even a written word, humans were trading goods and using different forms of materials as a medium of exchange. And so really, it's kind of important to think about money as a method for the exchange of value over time. And it's kind of a shared social consensus. And we've tried many different forms of money. We've tried everything from beads to seashells to precious metals to paper and money in the form that we kind of understand it today. And it's becoming increasingly digital. And so if you kind of observe that we've been trying to optimize and improve different tools we use to exchange and trade wealth over time, especially, in this era of the internet, we now have a sort of very interesting opportunity to reimagine money fit to purpose for a period of time where the connectivity of humans is now increasingly sort of facilitated by technology. And so if you just take a step back and you go, well, what do we need our money for? We need it to exchange wealth. What property should our money have? Well, it needs to probably be sort of rooted in mathematics and be divisible and fungible and counterfeit resistant. And then you get into some more philosophical questions like, well, where does it come from and how much should there be? And so, you know, in the context of, you know, sort of the 2008 financial crisis, you know, is born an idea, which was the Bitcoin white paper. And for your listeners, if you haven't actually taken the 15 minutes to go find this thing, it's online all over the place. It's available at bitcoin.org. It was published as sort of a small research paper, and it's readable by even people that do not have a technical background. And it's worth finding it and spending 15 minutes reading it, because it's a treatise to essentially imagine an alternative financial system. And the paper basically proposes using a technology protocol, a sort of a protocol for money. And it has some novel ideas in it, including having a distributed record-keeping system that is highly resilient and can basically stay in a constant state of agreement and have it be widely distributed so that there's not just one place where you'd have to change a variable in the record-keeping system, but have to be changed all over them, which would basically be impossible to do. And so the white paper introduces the idea. It then gets launched as a computer science protocol and is worked on by open source contributors and has now one of the sort of most widely contributed to kind of open source technical projects that's ever been developed. And so anyway, this is sort of the origin of it, but I learned about this a couple of years later. And so it launches in 2009. There's maybe a handful of computer scientists, cryptographers, and experts kind of focused on cypherpunks and economists basically tinkering with this thing. And then, you know, in 2011, a small community sort of grows, and there's a forum online called bitcointalk.org. And it was here that about, you know, a couple hundred people start to sort of talk a little bit more about, well, what would it take to sort of expand and elaborate this system that allows us to exchange precious information in a trustless way. And that's sort of the key breakthrough with crypto, is basically it's a peer-to-peer electronic cash. And that's just, if you have a mental model for it, it allows people to exchange precious information over the internet instantly across borders with no counterparty governing that exchange. So I basically, just like if I were to hand you a 5-pound note, once it's done, there's settlement and you can go use that 5-pound note on whatever you want. So a digital system for doing that. And so in this time period is when blockchain.com is sort of imagined. And at first, the very first thing we ever built was a website called blockchain.info. That was actually like a project that predates the company. Blockchain.info, though, was the first website that built a search engine in a user experience for looking at the record-keeping system known as the blockchain. And so we wanted to build a tool to examine what was happening on-chain, meaning we wanted to look at all of the economic history. We wanted to study the velocity, how fast transactions were happening, the distribution of the currency across the network. And so we were building basically informatic tools and visualizations of all this. And to this day, blockchain.com's Block Explorer is still one of the most widely cited and viewed websites for anyone that wants to basically look at the raw data. And so we visualize all that and make it easy to understand and digest. And doing so helped us kind of establish a foothold as an early participant in the market. We're very proud to be very early. Our birthday is October 15th, 2011, which I think makes us the oldest cryptocurrency project or company still in existence today. But that footprint was what got us in the door. And what we learned early on, and you know, at the time it was just some nerds working on this basically, was that there were people all over the world that were starting to adopt Bitcoin specifically. It was the only digital currency at the time. But if it was going to move beyond this very early adopter set of, you know, cryptographers, computer scientists, and really nerdy people, it was going to have to get easier to use. And so this is where ourselves and some early other contemporaries started building software to make it a little bit easier to basically work with. And so we built a wallet, which looks a little bit like your PayPal experience or online banking, to make it possible for people to send, receive, secure, and exchange these digital assets and instruments. And the first one we did that with was a Bitcoin wallet. And a wallet is a really key piece of sort of kit or infrastructure that you would want to have if you're going to use this technology. And so really important to understand, though, is there are different formats that you can use as a wallet. You can have a wallet that literally is like the kind that sits in your back pocket, where you are the sole custodian of the things you put in that wallet. So that wallet will have cash instruments, it might have digital payment instruments, might have identity instruments, and you can exchange those the information about those things with the people you want to. But you are firmly in control of the custody of what's in that wallet. Now, there are other types of formats where you can create almost an account structure. But in an account world, that's where someone else is actually holding custody of your funds. That's more like the relationship customers today have with a bank, which is different than the relationship you have with a wallet. But anyway, we built a wallet that was a non-custodial wallet. And this was really important because in the early days of crypto, and even more recently, we keep learning that if you centralize a lot of control and custody over valuable things, you increase the risks of either intrusion of or bad actors governance over that. And you can have bad catastrophic results from it. So very important to understand some of the risk management in the digital asset space. But blockchain.com's wallet has been downloaded by over 90 million people in almost in every country in the world, and is a very popular way for first-time users and advanced ones too to get into the digital currency space. But basically, it was the very first sort of crypto cycle sort of begins, I would say, in 2011 is when there's like a little bit of, noise. And then in 2013, you kind of have a real sort of upswing in terms of adoption, and over a million people basically sign up for digital currency platforms and products. And that's where we've, I would say, kind of really found our product market fit. And if you're a startup, that's really what you're obsessed about, is trying to find something that people value. And that was our real breakthrough year in terms of establishing, product market fit.
Well, Nick, I've got no questions left now.
Sorry about that.
Just covered everything in 10 minutes.
It's like going
minutes.
Down memory lane. I haven't talked about this in a while, but it was an interesting
time. So let's do that walk down, though, because as somebody who's been in the space for so long and has had product out in the market for that long, it's kind of interesting to explain to the listeners like how it evolved over time, because you and I have seen like probably four cycles now, which, not coincidentally coincide with the Bitcoin halving, but walk people through, like, when you guys started it up, what was there? I remember, because I remember the non-custodial wallet, but walk them through like each cycle, because each cycle, like the people who turn up to use it are different. And the product has to evolve because, as you say, usability is so important. Where does it start in its rudimentary form, and then the intermediate form, and then where it is now? And how does that link back to the people who are turning up to use it?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So adoption curves are pretty well documented now in terms of almost any type of new social experiment or product in the world. So whether it's a new type of music or a new technology, there's always sort of this skepticism at first. Then there are some early adopters, and then those adopters, bring in other people. And eventually you sort of have this moment where it switches from being something that, and there's this famous book called Crossing the Chasm, which every marketer in the world will know, but it switches from this like little thing to being mass market. And crypto has definitely crossed the chasm. But back in 2011, 12, and 13, these were really the early sort of building blocks were being put down that would establish crypto as a force to be reckoned with. But it needed infrastructure. You needed wallets, you needed exchanges, you needed on-ramps, you needed custody systems, you needed a lot of rigor, you needed on the security development, you needed scale on the protocols themselves to improve their speed and their reliability. And so if you think a little bit like building the infrastructure for a future city, you start by maybe paving a road, but then you need two lanes, you need to build a bigger highway so that you can facilitate ever increasing numbers of people to run on those things. And so in the digital world, there's actually it's quite similar. You start off with very simple protocols, and then they get more complicated as you go along the way. So anyway, in 2000, so when I say cycles in crypto, this is a really important concept to understand, but everyone will already understand it in the context of the macro economy. We have economists come on CNBC and Bloomberg every day, and they talk about the bull market, or they talk about a bear market, and they talk about a potential recession, or you know, things going well. And so there are periods of time where the market is expanding, and there are periods of time where it's contracting. And crypto does this too. It has years where it expands, where a lot more people start to participate in it, and it has years where it contracts, where there's less activity. And the difference is that in the macro economy, there are, you know, everyone's obsessed with what the Federal Reserve is going to do, how much they're hiking up inflation rates, you know, to deal with, you know, all the concerns in the economy about overheating. In the crypto space, though, you don't have these sort of human controls. You've got mathematical controls. And this market is also running 24/7, 365. It doesn't take bank holidays.
And globally, and so when, right?
Yeah. And so when the market in crypto overheats, it can also cool off very quickly. And so the cycles are contracted. So instead of there being these sort of long duration, you know, periods of growth or slowness in crypto, it just happens much faster. And so we've really arguably been through four crypto cycles in the past decade. And there was one in 2013, there was one in 2017, there was one in 2021. And since then, in 2022, we had a major correction. You have, you know, an enormous amount of investment that goes into building tools and companies and attracting customers, and some of them do really well, and then some of them don't work out. And this core of creative destruction is just happening in a very fast way in the crypto space. And so, to you know, this isn't a perfect you know, map of history, but it sort of looks a little bit like this, where you tend to have an incredible year where the asset class grows very significantly, a lot of new adopters come in, and then you have a year where it sort of, I would say, it goes sort of sideways, where there's not much activity. You have a corrective year where it deflates a little bit, and then you have another year where there's a large amount of growth and adoption. And so, you know, 2022 was a year where there was a huge amount of correction. You had a lot of malinvestment. You had some bad actors, you know, famously in the space that have been rooted out. And that's a good thing. Those individuals will be held accountable by the existing systems we have of governance and control to deal with fraud and bad actors. And in the, you know, in the recovery of that, you know, entities that have been around for a long time that have developed great trust with their communities and their customers, you know, big institutions are also moving into this industry in a meaningful way. And so 2023 has been a very strong year for crypto. If you look just from January 1st to today, crypto as an asset class is the best performing asset class of the entire market. And yeah, it shouldn't really be a surprise. You've got wide-scale global adoption happening, especially arguably in frontier and emerging markets, where the need for high-scale transactional systems, meaning the ability to make payments quickly, very seamlessly, with just, you know, a smartphone, without having to need banks and ATMs and settlement systems and clearing houses and all of this sort of legacy infrastructure that was necessary in the era where we were moving a lot of paper around, but less necessary in the area where we're moving a lot of electrons around. And so, you know, just to speak at a really structural level about what's happening in the economy, you know, we've been through a few sort of reorganizations from the 1880s when we had the first industrial revolution and mechanized steam. Then you have the assembly line, and you're able to build, you know, products like cars in a reliable way one after another. Then we have sort of the first computer revolution and you have PCs and the automation of mathematical computing. And now we're sort of moving into this new era where computer systems are evolving and making it possible for everything from extraordinary automation to the reorganization of electrons. And so if the last century was all about getting really good at moving atoms around and building products and things that we could use to improve our standard of living, the next century is really gonna be about moving electrons around in a more effective way. And so in order to do that, you need wide-scale transactional systems to do this for precious information. And so we're talking about a natively integrated financial system into the internet, enabling people around the world to move goods and services and pay for those things at much more efficient scale, basically. So in short, that's sort of a treatise on maybe the sort of transition that's happening and in our space, knowing that what we're really playing for and why there's been extraordinary investment from not just venture capital, but from growth capital and institutional capital now, is that the economy is becoming more digital, and it's going to make sense to invest in companies and tools that help create more efficient markets. And building a more efficient financial system is good for everybody. It means that we can build a bigger pie. And it's very obvious at this point that a digital financial system will be vastly superior to the type of financial structure that we had in the previous century. And so there's really not that much debate about that anymore, at least within even the biggest players in the market, meaning the asset managers like BlackRock, Fidelity, and WisdomTree, all of whom are racing to put products together because their customers are asking for them and because the trends are clearly demonstrating over time that more digitization and the digitization of financial services is extremely inevitable. And so the opportunity to participate and invest in those things and grow with it is just clear.
So there's two threads there, and then with the time we've got, we're going to go through each one. And you've touched on both, so it doesn't have to be in too much depth. But there's one piece there around cycles, and we're in 2023. It's now August. And as you said, the crypto is the best, one of the best asset classes performing at least year to date, which is for me hilarious. Not because it's unexpected, but just to watch kind of this like reckoning in essence. So we are in this point in the cycle. What are like two or three overt signs that suggest you where we're at and why? You've mentioned already asset managers moving into the space. But there's a few others, and then we'll go for the bigger question after that.
Yeah, sure. So there's especially important to understand the supply dynamics of at least the most valuable cryptocurrency today, which is Bitcoin. So I talked a bit about it earlier when we discussed sort of the design of money and how much of it there is and where does it come from. And so today, central banks create money, politicians create legislation, and they literally create money out of thin air, and then they lend it to banks, and those banks lend it on through the economy, and the supply of money is constantly growing. Now, it's supposed to be the responsibility of central banks to manage the inflation schedule in such a way that it's not growing too much, because if the amount of money is growing too quickly, everything starts to get more expensive in an uncontrollable way. And if you look at the amount of money, M1, in the money supply that was created over the past 3 years, basically since COVID, it's an extraordinary expansion in the money supply. And this is all publicly available information. You can go see this on Fred.org, which is the US Federal Reserve's statistical website. You go to the M1 chart and you'll see it skyrocketing because they printed an obscene amount of money, something like $8 trillion in the last few years. And so when you massively increase the currency supply, everything starts to get more expensive. It's not a surprise that we're seeing record costs and record bubbles in everything from the cost of fuel to the cost of food to the cost of education, the cost of healthcare. And this is a really painful thing for people in advanced economies, the United States included, the UK, where we've seen record inflation unseen in 50, 60 years. And so I mention this because the design of Bitcoin is extremely oppositional to this. It actually has a deflationary currency supply. And the way it works is every 4 years, the total amount of currency that gets released to the network basically drops by 50%. We call this a halvening, or the halvening of Bitcoin. And it will halve again at some point in early 2024. We roughly think it'll hit sometime in March, April, or May. It moves around a little bit, but it will. The total supply of Bitcoin will drop by 50%. And this is a really powerful dynamic, because if the same number of participants are joining the network and using Bitcoin and the supply is dropping by 50%, it causes the price dynamics to generally increase after one of these events. And so everyone in crypto, especially that is a Bitcoin holder or looking at the dynamics of the supply, of this asset class is very obsessed with the halving. And so that is a very key signal that is coming. It's well understood. It's very predictable. We know that it's going to happen. And unlike what's going on with central banks around the world, where you have no idea how they're going to change their opinions or minds or what they're going to do, raising rates or not, at least with the Bitcoin protocol, it's extremely predictable. We know it'll happen, and it'll happen next year. And so that's a major signal in sort of the cycle of the Bitcoin and crypto market, because if the supply decreases and the demand stays the same, the price of the asset class increases. And so that's a major signal, but there are more kind of important ones in some ways, which are just on-chain analytics. And so we can look at the total transactional history and the amount of transactions that are happening every single day. And if you go to blockchain.com, you can go to our charts and you can see that there are more transactions happening on a day-to-day basis today than at any previous point in time. So more people are adopting this payment mechanism and this currency to make payments over the internet. And there's some great examples of this type of adoption, especially happening in places like Ukraine, in Brazil, in Argentina, where it has been very, very difficult for people to protect their savings and wealth, where there's been massive amounts of inflation in their currencies. Also making payments has been encumbered by everything from terrible policy making,
capital controls to
capital controls, to all kinds of things. So it's worth mentioning that, like, this is getting adopted on a global basis. It's I think in some ways arguable that crypto in general will be much more useful in emerging and frontier markets at first, because there are places in the world like the United States or the UK that have relatively strong financial services today. That being said, earlier this year saw the four largest bank failures in U.S. history since WaMu, one after another. And these were supposed to be, highly regulated, very well-run banks. And these weren't little businesses. These are huge institutions. First Republic, Signature, Silicon Valley Bank, one after another. And so making the point that, even in our robust economies, there's, serious concern for some of the stability of these banks, with the type of out of control currency creation that we've witnessed over the past few years. So in short, the key data points I'm looking at are always user adoption, total network volume, and key moments, especially like a Bitcoin halving, which changed the supply dynamics in a way that if the demand is still there, then you're going to see price action on it.
Yeah, the interesting one I find there, I mean, I accept totally everything you said about Bitcoin. That's interesting, but you've covered it in ample detail. I was writing up some data the other day from BitRefill, which is basically like different chains used around the world for different things. And, what is fascinating in a way is that you've got the Bitcoin blockchain, it's used like widely throughout the world. That's a thing. But then you look at even like the Binance chain and Tron and the amount that they are used to transport US dollar tokens, what some people call stable coins. Like there's one of the ironies of the space is, what do people in certain parts of the world want desperately? US dollars.
Yeah.
Even given kind of the shortcomings.
You're making such a good point. And I wish I had brought it up before, but I'm excited to talk about it, because there's frequently this sort of discussion like, well, I don't really like the, I don't like this stuff, or I don't care. It's sort of it's almost irrelevant, because it's important to understand this as a technology that facilitates the expansion of adoption of US dollars at the same time as being an alternative asset class. So here's the rails that are important to get. There is now possible to use this protocol for money to create digital dollars. So you can create a unique digital good and then tokenize it. And so there are all kinds of projects to build what are called stable coins. This is a pegged one-to-one backed digital token that represents a US dollar. And all over the world, in countries like Turkey and the Philippines, we see huge adoption of stablecoins. These are people that live in these countries that just want access to dollars because the Turkish lira or the Filipino currency has deteriorated so quickly. They just want access to dollars. And so using crypto protocols, we're able to deliver dollars in the pockets of people all over the world with nothing but a smartphone, and immediately they have a direct relationship with the dollar. And this is so interesting because now they can move that dollar anywhere in the world instantly online, basically for free. And so just at the foundational level, sure, you can invest in crypto because maybe you understand the supply dynamics of Bitcoin and you see it being adopted and you think that'll be something to consider as a long-term hedge against all other things happening in the market. So just as a pure portfolio risk management strategy, you put a little bit of your asset that's into that. Or you accept that the technology is being used also to just facilitate wide-scale online commerce. And that's going to be valuable in and of itself. And so if you think about it, what you're sort of doing when you make you invest in these things is you're sort of purchasing transactional bandwidth on the internet. And that bandwidth is limited. And so if you believe that the expansion of the economy will happen online, that's your sort of thought, then you should probably have some exposure to this asset class. And that's why last week or 2 weeks ago, Larry Fink, the CEO and founder of BlackRock,
cheerleader Larry, asset
manager in the world, got on CNBC and was exuding the virtues of this global informatics asset class. And, 10 years after I started, when we began, everyone was so critical of everything. It was just, this stuff was never going to work. It was only used by nerds on the internet. And then it was only used, by bad actors on the internet. And there was all this constant criticism. And now you've got the CEO, the biggest asset manager on earth, talking about this as an entire new informatics asset class, digital information that's precious, data itself that could turn into value over time. And so, the conversation has dramatically changed. It's no longer just money for nerds. It's an entire protocol and fabric, an interface that enables people, regardless of the circumstances of their birth, to do basic things with their wealth, sending, receiving, trading, and exchanging it all in a digital medium and growing a bigger pie for everybody. And that's why, for those of us that have been working in this space for 10 years or longer, we have a long-term time horizon and conviction for the ultimate adoption of this because it's just better, cheaper, and faster. And so anytime something comes along that's difficult to understand and sort of paradigm changing, it always should be criticized and should be battle tested, and it has been over the last decade. I can assure you this stuff has been tested to the extremes, and it's still here. It's extremely resilient, and the proof is in the pudding, not just on the growth of the asset class itself, but in the day-to-day adoption of people all over the world to use these things to improve their lives. And that to me is the sort of the grand heuristic that is most important. Is just over time, more and more adoption happening, and at the end of the day, that's what's going to make this become ubiquitous. And most people within a few years from now won't even know that the tools they're relying on to exchange money over online or with their bank or whatever will actually be fundamentally built on these technologies. And it's sort of relevant because it's like, I live in a house, I love that there's lights in it, the lights all work on the electricity.
Yeah, and but what standard does it use, and what are the intricacies of the light bulb, Nick? Who cares?
So that's right.
Now, one of the things I like there is you mentioned the stable coins and US dollars. What I find fascinating is that people will use them and they get no interest on it. I mean, it's a little bit like your major bank, because they pay 0.5% interest on things that are meant to be yielding 5.5. Let's do a thought experiment. So you have two options, three, all right? You can have Bitcoin, you can have US dollar token, or you can have a treasury token that tracks short-term treasuries. What do you think people are going to pick, right? They're going to pick different things for different needs, right? So that idea that like the infrastructure's there and then it's just a matter of moving the assets, in inverted commas, across onto it, is obvious. I think it's obvious, but I'd like your thoughts on it, given that you are our esteemed guest.
Well, I'll maybe borrow some wisdom from Ray Dalio, who, famously last year, when asked the same question in front of a world stage, and on the stage with him are Schwartzman from Blackstone, Solomon from Goldman Sachs, Dalio's up there. And they asked everybody, what do you want to have in your bank? What if you've got $100 to invest, where do you put it? And, I think Solomon and Schwartzman both said they wanted dollars. And Dalio said, no, I want Bitcoin. And, you know, I think if we were to look at how that bet would have played out, you know, from that moment in time to now, you know, Dalio's bet is playing way stronger. But the point is that, you know, in the future, in not too distant future, finally access to these things won't be so complicated or difficult. And today, if you want to purchase some crypto, you should go to an exchange. You should go to one that's been running for a long time. You can go to blockchain.com. You can go to others that have been around for a while. It's important to work with a reputable, you know, firm that's been in the space for the duration. And you can sign up. It'll ask you to do everything like you would if you were to go to a broker dealer or anything else. You have to create an account. You have to tell them who you are. You have to, you know, wire money in or whatever, and then you can buy some crypto. And you can choose to either hold it on a wallet yourself or keep it on an account. And if you're going to do that, you got to be very careful to make sure you're working with a reputable firm. But you know, BlackRock, Fidelity, and even WisdomTree have applied to put ETFs to market right now. And so over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, we expect these ETFs to get approved. This will enable, you know, every broker dealer in the United States to now offer immediate exposure to these things in highly risk managed formats. And I'm really excited about this because it enables anyone just to start to allocate in a risk managed way with a portfolio mindset to this asset class. And that's why these new products are so exciting, because more and more people will be able to protect themselves from the real danger of, you know, runaway inflation just as a hedge in their portfolios by investing a little bit into these types of ETFs and products. And so the products that are now coming in the market are incredibly sophisticated, and they're going to sit right along with everything else that you expect to have in your broker dealer. So a lot of going on in this space, but that's really sort of the last sort of adoption heuristic is, when do the biggest asset managers in the world start to offer this in the form of an ETF? And as soon as they do, the passive allocation to this asset class will continue for perpetuity. And to me, that's sort of the last mile of the adoption curve is really that sort of achievement. So, you know, it took 10 years, but here we are, and the last of the great institutions are building products for this asset class. And once those are embedded, you know, it's off to the races.
I'd like to layer another piece on there. And I do it partly because we had Alex Leishman from River on the other week, and he talked about the Bitcoin in the context of investing or saving and spending. Now, you've just pointed out like a portfolio approach to investing, and I kind of posed the question earlier, what would you hold, Bitcoin, US dollars, or US treasuries, right? So it's a thought experiment. But the kind of corollary is, why wouldn't you hold it all in Bitcoin? Following Ray Dalio and a bunch of other people's kind of view, like the ability to spend it. And I mean, I don't know about what offerings you folks have, but I am going to throw out the idea that investing is one thing, fine, but the ability to spend it is another. Do you see that as part of the adoption curve and something that is a necessary requirement to move along, or is it unnecessary and kind of beside the point?
I think the adoption by merchants, small businesses and medium-sized businesses, to accept it as a form of tender, basically, has trailed the adoption of it as an investment. And so we're still sort of lagging on what I would say like the payment side, especially for Bitcoin, which has sort of landed more almost in the, if I were to describe it as like a digital gold more than necessarily its original intention to be a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. It is my view over the next 10 years that both can be achieved. There's a lot of work being done to basically help facilitate Bitcoin as a payment system for electronic payments online. And there's technologies that are being developed to increase the scalability of the payments, basically. That being said, like the adoption by merchants is just going to take a little more time. My view is that we're probably 10 years away before you're meaningfully seeing people paying for goods on their day-to-day with digital cash instruments. Like Bitcoin specifically. But, however, right now, you can buy almost anything you want with digital currency. You can buy Ferraris, you can buy, there's properties you can purchase. There's a small shop in London that sells tacos that you can buy with Bitcoin. Now,
good tacos. It's
most, you know, these are smaller, small businesses today. But over time, I expect, especially online companies to be sort of the first adopters of these things. And we already sort of see that. There's plenty of online merchants that accept digital forms of currency and payments. And almost every single major gaming platform in the world has games with basically native digital currencies being launched and integrated into them. And so it's just a matter of time before all this stuff basically gets, percolated through. But there's a lot of adoption still to happen, especially on the payment side.
I suspect it's going to be a question of service providers who basically change the cryptocurrency into whatever at the end.
Yeah,
and like people don't even know.
Will probably pay out of an instrument, like almost like a basket of goods, and it'll be, quite fluid in how it's exchanged and traded and immediately settled into the currency of the desire of the recipient. And so building a lot of those things is of a high priority to many firms and ourselves included.
Yeah. Hey, look, we're coming up on time. We're going to close out the episode. You've already alluded to this a bit, but we always like to do it for the listeners, which is like, what have you got your eye on for the future? Like, what is the one thing that you think that's maybe not obvious to people, because that's especially useful?
Well, it's a big question.
It is.
It's impossible not to sort of talk today in 2023 about the sort of step function changes in, what is now broadly described as artificial intelligence. But really what's happening is computer systems are getting, a lot better at managing large amounts of data. And I'm really excited about the concept of data as an asset class itself, and we as humans create huge amounts of data. Every time we search, we take photographs, we share those things. There's just this extraordinary replication of ever increasing amounts of data, and some of this data is extremely valuable. But we don't have a good way of monetizing that data on an individual basis. So I'm talking about maybe your personal biometrical information that can be used to tailor pharmaceutical drugs, life extension technologies, all kinds of things. So I think it's pretty interesting to think about over the next 10 years how data that we produce could actually be owned by ourselves and then anonymously shared, collected, and then sold and bought and sold as an asset class itself. And then the individuals that create that data to actually be compensated for producing it. And so this has huge implications, not just in my own autonomy over my information, but being able to monetize it. But really what I'm talking about is artists being able to be compensated for their work in a direct way, musicians that create music to actually tokenize their intellectual property rights and share it with their fans. And every time that music is listened to online, to have a little bit of the value of the song basically paid out to the listeners. So what we've created with blockchain technology, really to understand it, is a global property rights system for digital information. And that has almost limitless possibilities for changing business models that more directly align potentially the creators of music and art and data, and having those people be directly compensated for those things. And so I'm really excited about all that. I just think that the future is going to be really weird in ways we don't anticipate yet, but I think it'll be, it is going to build a bigger pie. The digitization of everything is happening, and blockchains are a fundamental technology for building a global property rights system. I'm excited about that. So I think it's going to be, a bigger market, it creates more peace in the world. It helps increase people's standard of living. And this is going to be a foundational and fundamental change to the way we interact with wealth. And it's inevitable, just as we've tried different forms of technologies to improve the way we exchange and trade goods over time. blockchains are the sort of next step in iterating on an ever improving process to build a better form of money.
Nick, you know, the best and worst part about that last question is it always brings up so many things that I'd love to discuss more.
Well, we'll do it again next time.
I spent years thinking about the economics of information, and you've just touched on so many issues. I had an accounting professor, I almost did a PhD in accounting, and I said the only interesting thing in studying is intangible assets, intellectual property. She said, none of the accountants care about that. That's a horrible idea. And she did me a great service because I just went and did it anyway. I just don't have a piece of paper for it, as if I can.
That's right.
There's so much there.
Thank you so much for the conversation, Benjamin. I really enjoyed it today. And now I've got a bunch of stuff I got to go think about.
That's cool. Nick, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Please, you can catch up with me on Twitter or recently rebranded X. My name is NICCARY on Twitter. And look forward to following you on the internet.
Nice one. With that, we're out of time. I hope everyone found today's podcast useful and informative. I certainly did. US people, wisdomtreeprime.com. Check it out. Find me at the Bird app, at Benjamin Dean. Nick, thank you. And thank you to the listeners. I hope you enjoyed it. Have an excellent day.